Hello, 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 ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Daily Friend Wrap. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Marius Ruart. Let's get into the news stories of today. And the first one is more fallout from the report done by Treasury into the condition of Eskom. So Treasury got a German consultancy group, VGBE Energy, to look into the problems at Eskom and why the utility was performing so badly. And long story short, the report basically found that the management processes were far too complex. There's way too much red tape, and that Eskom was being not underfunded, but just kind of badly managed. And kind of to point out as to how things could be working, the group pointed out that one of the best performing units of the entirety of Eskom's power generation fleet is Unit 4 at the Kusile coal power plant. So there's this thing called energy availability factor, which is basically how often a power plant is producing electricity. In the so far this year, the average for Eskom's fleet has been somewhere around 51% of the time the power units are actually working. Unit 4, however, has a 90% energy availability factor. Now, you may wonder as to why this is, and one of the perhaps the answers to this is that it is in fact not directly run by Eskom, but is in fact run by the original equipment manufacturer for the boiler used in the unit at that at Kusile. Talking about the report, talking about the staff competence, they say that at Kusile in particular, there is a problem with training, that a lot of the staff haven't actually been trained to operate the newer technology. They say that the staff seems to lack incident investigation skills and are not as competent as they ideally need to be at analyzing the root causes of problems and fixing them. They say that there's quite a lot of theoretical knowledge amongst Eskom staff, but a lot of them suffer from also kind of on deficit of on hands hands-on rather knowledge, as well as problems with leadership, and that the former leadership programs that Eskom used to have been scrapped. In fact, one of the things the report makes clear is that Eskom really is not doing as much training as it definitely needs to be doing. So it's not producing the next generation of competent technicians. Marius, what do you make of this? Once again, we're seeing a pattern so often in South Africa, which is that it's not actually a lack of money, it's a lack of using that money properly that is the source of many of our problems.
Yeah, and I think this also shows how where the private sector can work with the government to, solve a problem like this. I think an argument could be made something like Eskom shouldn't necessarily be completely privatized. Just, I mean, because of the nature of the beast. But shows where the private sector does help. I mean, we're getting 90% energy availability factor, and like you said in the beginning, most of the power plants are only at about 50%, and that's from what I've seen is the lowest basically ever that Eskom's done. And we all know, I mean, everybody's listening to this, I'm sure, knows about the problems with Eskom and how it affects everything, including the economy. And it's yeah, that's obviously not great. But I think the issue of training is an important one. I've got a friend who lives in Australia. He was just here recently. He moved there in about end of 2021, and he was talking to a guy who works for Western Australia's their Eskom, basically their energy provider. And the guy was telling him, I can't remember the exact number, but the number of South Africans that are working for that energy provider, and they're all technicians, like quite important posts, not management, but just making sure things are working. Said the number of South Africans there is actually crazy. He also spoke to another guy who works for the rail system in Western Australia, and the same kind of issue. So many Transnet engineers have gone over there. So it shows, firstly, how many how, the skills that we've lost in South Africa and all this kind of institutional knowledge that's also not getting passed on. And I think that's also a problem. Also, I'm sure people listening are under no illusions about the issue of the brain drain in South Africa, but something we can't forget about. And it's, yeah, it's pretty concerning if Eskom technicians aren't being trained properly in how to kind of manage the issues. And I think that's obviously shows you if they're pretty good at the theoretical side, but not ne necessarily the practical side. That probably means they're not being able to shadow somebody or not really be able to work as apprentices, because it's all easy enough to learn the theory in a classroom, but something else to actually apply it. And somebody's got to actually show you how to apply it, somebody who knows what they're doing. And obviously, this probably shows that a lot of the guys who can show the technicians coming up how to actually manage these problems simply aren't there anymore. So, but yeah, I think this is one of the issues where I think public-private partnerships can work pretty well. And it's something that we, I mean, it's obviously a solution staring us in the face, but we know how wedded the ANC is to statism and this kind of ideology where it's got to control everything, that it's not a solution the ANC is probably going to look at.
All right, let's move on to our next story. And this is reported by News 24, an absolutely horrifying case from Northwest Province, where a man named Kenneth Shesebe was, he says, abused by the police when they attempted to arrest his son. He has been awarded 400,000 rand by a court in the Northwest to be paid to him by the police ministry for pain, suffering, discomfort, embarrassment, loss of amenities of life, deprivation of freedom that were unlawful and unjust when the police arrested him on accusations that he had helped his son escape police custody. It's a little bit of a complicated story, but to try and summarize it, Shesebe's son, who's 17 years old, was accused by the police of being involved in a service delivery protest, and the police asked him to gather his son and his son's friends, who were also accused, and make them hand themselves over to police custody. He agreed to do this, but while he was using his son to gather some of these friends so that they could show up at the house and be handed over to the police, or at least have a conversation with the police, a bunch of local children were chased into Shesebe's house by a police officer, who then proceeded to, without saying a word, fire his gun in the air, kick down the front door of this house, and drag the children away physically into the back of the police van. Shesebe was then taken as well to the police station to see video footage of how his son had allegedly been behaving badly. And while he was there, he saw one of the police officers standing on the head of one of the accused kids for apparently taking part in the service delivery. He confronted the police officer, at which point he says he was assaulted, beaten, and then held in jail for 10 days without properly, you know, being served his rights or any of that kind of stuff. The court found that there was no sufficient evidence to have put him away in prison, so they've awarded him damages. But Marius, this is not even the first police brutality story in South Africa that we've heard in a while. These things go on constantly, and many of the times they're just not reported, particularly because they happen to kind of poorer people out of the way, and there's no political hay to be made, so people just don't seem to care.
Well, yeah, I read a study a little while ago. It looked at the police in South Africa, Brazil, and the US. And the US and Brazilian police are often thought of as, you know, kind of militarized. And, you know, a lot of people in the US want to abolish the police because, you know, they're so terrible and so on. But on a per capita basis, South African police kill more people than the Brazilians or the Americans. And that tells you something. And, yeah, as you say, there's probably so many cases we don't even hear about. And the ones that we do hear about, I mean, nothing really even happens to people who are responsible for it. I mean, I've spoken about it before, the Collins Causa, who was beaten to death during COVID for basically drinking a beer. Nobody has lost their job over that. It's a disgrace. But one thing to mention about this is actually an example where the system is actually working in a way. So this guy, Kenneth Shesebe, or whatever his name is, I mean, he managed to get damages awarded to him, and you know, 400,000 rand is nothing to sneeze at, but you know, he managed to go through the courts found for him, you know, his civil rights. Obviously they were damaged at the time, but the courts recognized this and they gave him, you know, this restitution to try and make it up for it. This doesn't excuse what the police did, obviously, but there are still avenues that people can go to fight this kind of thing. I mean, if this had happened in, say, in Zimbabwe or Rwanda, he probably would never come out after the 10 days. Or if he decided to moan, he probably would have been put back in jail, and he probably wouldn't have come out of it at then. So obviously it's not, you can't condone what the police did. But in a way, that shows that the South African system is working, sort of, in a way it's kind of supposed to work. But yeah, but it's also just shows you the way the police think about citizens in South Africa is an absolute disgrace, and it's something that's it's actually a big problem.
Well, I think it shows that the courts are still functioning to some degree, but the police, particularly in some of our more rural areas, are completely out of control.
More as an occupying force than a police service.
No, exactly. And that's when they're not being infiltrated by criminal gangs, which is a thing that definitely happens quite often. Okay, let's move on to our next story. And this is about one of the more serious of the up-and-coming political parties, the MK Party, the party that is supported by Jacob Zuma. The party has released its manifesto. And let's just say that the manifesto was light on details. It's like around about a page and a half, maybe, with just two very short, very vague points behind each policy area. In fact, it's so vague that you can kind of fill in whatever you want to as to what you think their manifesto is. So, for example, electricity policy. The MK party says that it will be stabilizing and expanding the grid. It will extend the electrical grid to all corners of South Africa, ensuring enough capacity to build to power our industry future from raw material processing to manufacturing. There's no more detail. Education policy, they want a market-related skills approach, adopt a skills-first approach that meets market demands, ensuring education aligns with the needs of our economy. It's not clear whether that's at higher education or tertiary or primary or whatever. Overhaul law enforcement agencies to improve efficiency and effectiveness in combating crime and corruption. That's going to be a little bit of a stretch considering Jacob Zuma is the party's face. Land redistribution is interesting because it doesn't use the phrase expropriation without compensation, but it's also so vague as to have no idea what it actually means. Fast track land redistribution policies while maintaining food security and increasing food exports. In other words, give people land without any consequences. Then there's, of course, this one, traditional leadership policy, strengthen the role and authority of traditional leaders in governance and community development, ensuring their participation in the decision-making processes that affect their communities. That sounds quite benign, but Jacob Zuma has been more explicit on this, saying during the selection campaign that traditional leaders should have the right to veto any legislation passed by parliament and basically should be the upper house of South African politics, able to, govern legislation in the country despite not being a democratic institution themselves. Kind of interesting. I think the funny thing about this manifesto is in many ways it doesn't actually seem that bad, considering, you know, what you might expect from the MK party, but also that it's so vague and so sort of, it just feels like it was slapped out in 15 minutes by, you know, an intern at the office or something. I think this is a great example of how what's written on the page is not necessarily what the party is really about.
Yeah, well, we've also heard Jacob Zuma in a speech recently said he wants to repeal legislation about same-sex marriages. He wants to send pregnant teenagers to Robben Island, for example, to have their baby and, you know, can do degrees and stuff there. So that's all, yeah, pretty crazy stuff, but that's nothing of that's in the manifesto. So, but maybe this upper house of traditional leaders won't be that bad. It works okay in the UK with the House of Lords. I would guess that's probably a bit different.
It's a little bit different there, but yes.
But I mean, I'm actually surprised they even came out with a manifesto. Like I said to you, I would have thought that a manifesto would just be on every page, something saying Viva Mshololozi. So, you know, actually maybe this is a surprise, but as you say, this is pretty much, you know, if you're a hard left Marxist, you'd probably read this and say, oh, okay, that's okay. And then people like us who, you know, centrist liberals or whatever you want to call us, will be like, oh, it doesn't seem that bad, but the devil is always is in the details. And we're going to have to wait to see if we get something a bit more hefty coming out of the MK party. I mean, I wouldn't hold anybody's breath for it, because I think it's basically been formed basically just for Jacob Zuma to get back at the ANC. I don't think there's really any... you know, I don't think they actually really want to govern South Africa. I think this is just about, you know, a revenge party from Jacob Zuma, I think. So, yeah, but it's up. At least they've come out with something. But it's also quite a lot like a lot of other political parties' manifestos where they say we want fewer bad things and more good things. That's also pretty much what this one's saying.
But of the major political parties that are going to get at least a couple seats in parliament, it looks like, I think MK probably has the shortest manifesto by far, and I think the EFF has the longest with their 260 pages of, you know, summoning unicorns with magical, you know, money exactly. That doesn't exist. But anyway, that's all the time we have for today. We hope that you found the show interesting. Please do go and check out our campaign website at pledgetovote.co.za. If you're interested in making your voice heard in the elections, please go check that out and sign up. Thank you very much for your time. We'll see you tomorrow on the Daily Friendship.